Nice.
We're doing it. Yeah, this is Rock to Recovery, and I'm your host, Wes Gear, just flying by the seat of my pants. As per normal, this is KX93.5 FM. Let me see, have we pushed all the buttons, the things recording, the Facebook Live is going, we got the hoop, and yeah, we got it all going. KX93.5 FM, Rock to Recovery Radio. I am your host, Wes Gear. Why are we here? Oh yeah, by the way, also brought to you by our friends, New Vista Behavioral Health. If you're looking for treatment, mental health, addiction, etc., there's a lot of shady programs out there doing shady work. New Vista Behavioral Health is legit. Please check them out. Oops, I dissed my friend. There we go. Okay. We're angling the Facebook Live. I want to make sure my boy's in the picture good and all that. All right, so why are we here? So I'm a sober dude that somehow didn't die from my addiction. And somehow in that process of finding how to heal, get help, change who you are, you get really excited about your life and you want to share that light with other people. And, you know, everybody these days has lost somebody or knows somebody who's addicted or has mental health issues or whatever, right? Or a wounded veteran or whatever. So this show is about interviewing people who've been through those near-death experiences, whether it be addiction, mental health, eating disorders, combat, whatever it is, and found a way out, but not just a way to survive and limp into the next stages of life, but to get into what I like to call the vortex of radness. My homie is getting excited. You know, because this is what we find when we find recovery, when we get rid of the stuff, not just the drugs or the behavioral stuff. When we get to that other side, all of a sudden life gets incredible. It gets amazing. So in interviewing rock stars, celebs, whoever, cool people, rad humans, we get to hear these stories of how they did that. And tonight's no different. I got my man who came up here from San Diego. And you can find him, by the way, on Instagram as One Hope Dealer. His name is Chris Stewart. That's a typo right there, huh? It's not Christ Stewart.
No, it's not, but I saw that and I'm like, hey, that's awesome, man. These guys know what I'm all about.
The team got it a little bit wrong. It's yeah. Chris Stewart. He's the author of a number one Amazon bestseller, Prayers, Punk Rock, and Pastry, which is the heart and soul of his story of hope. Chris is also a dynamic speaker. You were talking before we went on air how you love to do the speaking, the motivational speaking.
Love it.
He was voted into the top 200 entrepreneurs of 2016 for his company, Buns and Roses Baking Company, which that makes me jealous. I'm like, dang, that's legit, son. That is legit. And the company helps at-risk youth and adults that need a second chance to get back on their feet by learning a trade. That is so cool. You can hear his story right now. He's going to tell it all to you tonight. So welcome to the show, Chris.
Wes, thanks for having me, man. It's an honor to be on the show. And, you know, I love rock. I love recovery. And so I'm fired up to be here, as I'm sure you can tell. But, yeah, man, I got a message of hope for everybody listening out there. So get ready.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm stoked that you're here. Thank you for driving up from Whale's Vagina.
Yeah, you know what I mean? It's paradise on earth. What can I tell you? Although it's not so bad here in Laguna either. You know what I mean? We could be in a lot worse places.
I'm telling you. And sometimes when I deal, because I work probably like you with people struggling, and I'm like, dude, when this one guy comes to mind, I will not name, but he's like, gets bummed out a lot. I'm like, bro, you drive a Mercedes. Yeah. You live in Laguna. You're pretty much handled. You don't really have to do anything all day except figure out where you're going to go eat your next meal, which is pretty much anywhere you want. So, yeah, life's good.
It's great.
We're in Orange County, California, or San Diego, California. We're living good. But still, that head tells us otherwise, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's always something wrong.
I know. So tell me, you know, we like to get into, like, the what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. For you, where would you start your story?
Well, I'll tell you, man, for me, my story started when I was about 6 years old. And, you know, my number one addiction, I'll just tell you right off the bat, is music. You know, it's rock and roll, man, since a very early age. And probably sugar was a close second. And then I graduated to the other stuff we'll get to later. But, you know,
you said it starts at 6 years old.
Yeah.
So music started being a problem at six, or well, sugar did, or...
Yeah, I'll tell you what it was. Is I was at my neighbor's house, and we snuck into his brother's, his older brother's room. And there was a, you know, a sign on the door that says "Keep out," you know. And we're like, "Let's go in."
Man. Yeah.
And I remember we walked in, and up on the walls, man, the guy had like all these pictures of like Kiss and all these like Playboy centerfolds. And I remember just looking at my buddy and going, "Whatever it takes to get a room like this, I'm gonna do." Right. Yeah. And I kind of like just put that into motion. And normally that wouldn't be a problem, right? Except for me, because when I walked back across the street and I went into my house, we had another sign on the door, and that sign said, "In this house, we will serve the Lord." Huh. And I knew that what I had just seen and what I had just manifested and where I was at was not going to match together, right? I was already at a dilemma. And
Are you serving the rock and roll gods or the Lord?
Yeah, you know, and I thought, well, and, you know, and the thing was, is that at, you know, when you're that young or whatever and you're going through life, you know, I hear a lot of, you know, addicts talk about how they didn't feel like they were a part of, and I didn't really, I never felt like that. You know, I got along with a lot of people and things like that. But for me, what it was is that I felt that, like, I'm never going to be able to be in God's presence as who I am.
Huh.
You know, it was like kind of like this, like, kind of like the shame already started to build.
Yeah, where did that message come from? What kind of religion were you exposed to?
Well, my parents were pretty hardcore Christians, and in fact, they became missionaries. And so
were they the type that were saying you got to, you know, let Jesus in your heart, you're going to burn in hell?
Yeah. You know, it was like one of those things of where, you know, kind of like back in the '50s, you know, like rock music was the devil himself, you know?
Yeah.
And, so like growing up, I was only allowed to listen to like Amy Grant records and, you know, it was like torture, man. And,
yeah.
And, you know, and I progressed from there and, you know, and the thing is, I was, you know, I was a good kid. I didn't get in a lot of trouble. And, you know, I got decent grades. I wasn't great at that. And, I, you know, I like to play sports and stuff. And then when I started getting older, you know, I had, I remember, like, I got to listen to, like, Pat Benatar. And I was like, oh, that was, like, a big deal, you know. And don't worry about that if you're listening. It's not important. But the, you know, luckily I had an aunt who was into cool, like, old rock and roll. And she turned me on to, like, Elvis and Johnny Cash and stuff. And so that was kind of allowed. But
now, in your mind, did Elvis play nice with the Lord?
He did.
Which is interesting because when Elvis came out, he didn't, right? They couldn't show him from the waist down and, you know.
He was.
So
like,
the levels of Satanism changed throughout the years.
And I was like, you know, like the Elvis I met was a cool Elvis. You know, I didn't know what all that other stuff was about. And, well, you know, so it just progressed, you know. And then when I got into like, you know, 11 and 12 and 13, you know, I started hanging out and like listening to metal. You know, I really got into metal. And that was definitely not allowed. And, you know, it's funny.
What bands?
So, like, you know, back then it was like Van Halen and Scorpions and Motley Crue was a big one. Iron Maiden. My favorite band, probably Twisted Sister. Like, I love Dee Snider, man.
I was into that guy, like my dad.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, like, my most prized possession, I think, is my autographed Twisted Sister Stay Hungry album that I have hanging on the wall,
man.
Right? It says, "Chris, stay hungry." I'm like, oh, that's awesome, dude. And
that's good.
You know, it's funny, I was thinking like how full circle life comes. You know, today I started off my day teaching Sunday school today, right?
You did?
Yeah. And I do a lot of programs with kids and I love kids. And so it's cool for me though, because, you know, normally most people don't think of like a recovered addict who's fully tatted up coming in and being the Sunday school teacher. You know what I mean? At least that's what I didn't grow up with that. You know, I grew up with like kind of like the Ned Flanders kind of guy, you know, like, hey, neighbor, like, let's talk about the Lord.
Shoodly doodly.
Right? Yeah. Right. And, but it's funny because I was sitting there today and I'm thinking about it and, you know, the first time that I ever had to do that, or the only other time I've ever had to do that, when I was 13, my dad had gone through my stuff and he had found the Iron Maiden Number of the Beast.
Uh-oh.
And he just blew
it. This is the missionary dad.
Yeah, this is the missionary
dad. He's like, all my work and this is what I get.
What is this? You know, I'm like, I don't know who put that there, Dad. You know
what
I mean, right? And so then I had to go into church that day and give this like little talk about how, you know, Iron Maiden is the devil and how I'm like,
you
going
had to renounce
hell.
Them.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Which was like tough for me because I'm like, I love Iron Maiden. You know, when you're like a kid, you don't know what all that stuff means. And plus, obviously I'm not, you know, wasn't a Satan worshiper. You know what I mean? I just like the music. You know what I mean? And
yeah, you had Number of the Beast. So for people that don't know at home,
right.
Number of the Beast, Iron Maiden album is a scene where there's their monster Eddie puppet handing the devil who's puppet handing something else, and the whole like earth is on fire, and there's all these demons dancing, and there's little silhouettes of people having sex in there.
Yeah, like, it's like, I mean, it's like the Antichrist.
But didn't you stare at the album cover and you go, oh, look over here? Like, there was like a little bug, like a giant centipede, and these people are having sex hidden. You're like, wow.
Yeah, I was like, man, those guys are hardcore, right? And then plus it was like that, and then a combination between that and like Motley Crue, you know what I mean? Yeah. So it's like, shout out the devil.
Yeah.
I used to try and talk to my mom, be like, no, mom, it's shout at the devil, right? Devil, I'm like, you know, let me see if I can fix it. And then my mom's like, totally. You know, my mom's like this beautiful, like little old Christian little lady. So she's like, well, that's nice of them.
Well, and yeah, like, well, at least they're shouting at the devil and not with the devil.
And,
I had all these same battles too, by the way.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, that's the thing, man. People, you know, you got to understand, man. That's how it started for me. And, you know, but what happened is that me and my dad, you know, like we just didn't get along. And so when I was 15, he came to me and he was like, hey, Chris, you know, me and your mom, we feel like we've been very tolerant of your music and of your hair choices and things like that. But we're missionaries. And at the time I had like this mohawk and, you know, and I'd done it without permission, so I was already in trouble for that. And, you know, it's just this little skater kid. You know, I wouldn't hurt nobody. I never got into fights. I was never getting in trouble. You know what I mean? Yeah. But that's just what it was, man. And so what happened is that, you know, I was into metal, and that was going good. But everybody in metal had, like, long hair. And you'd listen to the albums, and you're like, man, like, I was a bass player. And I'm like, I can't really play that bass. And everybody was playing guitar. It was like Eddie Van Halen. I'm like, I can't do that either. And
shredding.
Drums cost, like, $2,000. We were poor white trash. And I'm like, that ain't never happening. And so I'm like, you know.
Where'd you grow up?
Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon.
Until I was 16, and then I moved to Hollywood.
Okay.
And that's where we're going right now. So he was
and
like, you know.
And your parents were full-time missionaries? That was their vocation, if you will?
Yeah. My dad used to work at a bank, and then, you know, through his own challenges in life, he also had some alcoholic problems and stuff like that. And so he kind of kept turning to the Lord every time he'd screw up, so we kind of became more religious as time went on, you know what
and
I mean?
And did that work for him to stay stopped on the drinking
for a while? Yeah,
so he's a periodic kind of on and off.
Yeah.
Now how was his behavior when he was drinking? Was he abusive? Did he do anything crazy? Cheat on mom?
Yeah, he was a you know, most of the time he wasn't around the house when that happened, but then, you know, like we would have to move and he would say, oh, I got a promotion or something, and then we'd find out later it was because, you know, like he was harassing people at work, let's say. And right, back in like the 80s and 70s, like, you really
it's hard to harass.
Yeah, right? It was hard to harass. It's not like today where you look at somebody wrong and they're like, you're out of here. I mean, back then, I'm pretty much sure, you know, like he was, I don't know what was going on, but it was definitely uncalled for, especially for a man of the Lord.
I mean, now and, if you sneeze and you don't cover your mouth, it's an assault. But
exactly. You know what I mean?
So
now
dad
like
was
crazy.
Running amok, huh?
Yeah.
And then so his way to make himself feel better was to serve the Lord and do the missionary stuff.
Yeah. You know, he was trying, you know. You gotta say God bless him for trying, I guess. But and you know, and he had a lot of trauma that, you know, we found out later, you know, that stuff he never dealt with in his life, because you didn't deal with trauma back in those days. You know, it wasn't like nobody had therapy and all that kind of stuff. He just held it in, became the man, don't talk about it, you know, that kind of stuff.
It seems like our parents' therapy or whatever mantra was like, suck it up, you know, don't just go on, press on, don't feel that, son, don't let it bother you, go, right?
You're a man, handle it.
You're a man, handle it. You're like, but I just got sodomized behind the gym and I want to talk, whatever it was, right? My uncle touched me where I pee or whatever it is. Just be tough.
Yeah.
Go earn your keep.
I'm sure he didn't mean it.
Oh, he's just drunk.
he's just drunk.
It doesn't mean anything.
You're a liar. You're making that up.
Yeah, you're making that up.
I hear that from a lot of kids that I work with. I'm like, what? That's crazy to me. You know what I mean? And And so, you know, he said, so basically he said, so it's my way or the highway. You know, like you're getting regular hair. We're moving to, at that point, they were moving over to Europe to become full-time missionaries.
Wow.
And I was a sophomore in high school. And so he was like, you know, so there's the deal. You're coming with us or you're not. And I thought about it for a couple of days. And I was like, you know what? I decided I'm not. And, you know, I want to be a rock star. Yeah. You know, and at the time, you know, I would say like
you're
ignorance
16.
Was kind of 15 at this point.
15.
Yeah.
And your parents are giving you the choice to not go with them to Europe. And what was your contingency plan?
Well, luckily, you know, I was a workaholic too. So I had like a paper out. And also I had about, you know, at that point, $500 in the bank, which back in like 1985 or whatever was a good amount of money.
Yeah, a
you
couple
know?
G's.
Yeah, right. And plus, you know, I had wanted to be this rock star since I was like 6 years old or this larger than life figure. And so I was like, you know what? Like, I don't really like you anyway. And I don't like living here and I don't
Did
like
you
these
say
rules.
That?
Yeah. And I'm like, so here it is. So it was like a bass guitar and a skateboard and a backpack. I'm like, later. And I took off and, you know, and I went and I lived, you know, in the house in, you know, like on the couches of my little punk rock friends, you know, and
how'd you know people in LA?
Well, what happened was I had a buddy of mine who was older and, he was moving to LA to start a band.
Gotcha.
And so he was like, hey, listen, man, I'm moving to L.A. So I left home at the end of day after Christmas, And he came to me like, I don't know, like first of February. And he was like, hey, listen, I'm moving to LA to start a band. You want to go? I said, man, I've been waiting my whole life to hear that, bro. Let's go.
Right? Dude, moving to LA.
Van.
Yeah.
Get in the van, man. Let's go.
The supreme sacrifice for rock and roll. It's basically like a Twisted Sister video, the I Want to Rock video.
It
the
is.
Guy comes and spitting.
I was thinking that, man. Like, what are you going to do with your life?
Exactly.
And I'm like, I want to rock. That's all I said.
Go, if you don't know it, go right now, look up Twisted Sister I Want to Rock video, and this
It'll
is
change
Chris
your life.
Stewart's
it is.
Life.
It is. It's totally my life, and I think it's probably why I love Dee Snider so much, because I'm like, he's the only one that understands me. You know, so I moved to L.A. when I was, like, 16, you know? Like, literally, I turned 16 March 15th, and we moved, like, April 1st. And
that now, looking back, that is young.
Dude, that's insane.
Do you have kids?
No.
No, yeah, I don't either. But I hear that it would be weird.
Yeah. I mean, I work with kids that are that age, and I'm like,
right,
I can't believe, you know? And I look, I'm like, what a baby. You know what I mean? Like, what was going on?
15, 16 to go to L.A. by themselves. Right. Now I feel like the Child Protective Services would be like, what are you doing?
They probably would have back then, but they didn't have enough social media to get a hold of. You still had to call people on the phone, wait, nobody's answering, and they're like, yeah, if you can find him, cool, but, you know, nobody was cruising around.
And you weren't scared at all. You're stoked. You're like, yeah, let's go get him.
Yeah, I couldn't wait, man. I was, like, all about it, you know? You gotta remember, too, like, in this era was, like, MTV, so, like, everybody I saw that I looked up to was, like, famous and had everything I wanted to be. So I'm like, oh, I'm just gonna meet those guys, and then they're gonna realize how cool I am, and then it's gonna be odd, you know what I mean?
You sold your soul for rock and roll.
I did sell my soul for rock and roll. I mean, that's tattooed across my back.
Call a spade a spade. Really?
All right. Yeah.
Wow.
It's a huge bag that says, sold my soul. But, you know, so anyway, when I got to L.A., man, it was things changed, you know, like that. And not in a good way, really, you know. And at this point, I dabbled a little bit, you know, like been turned on to some weed and, you know, and I drank a little bit. But, you know, when you're living pretty much on the streets of L.A. at 16 years old, man, you realize quickly that, like, drugs and alcohol are not really your friend, you know, because all the people that take them, bad things happen to, you know. And I had a lot of friends, mostly girls, you know, they'd get drunk and then something would happen at a party and, you know, and they're coming to you like, dude, that dude did this. I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm like 16, you know.
Yeah.
I mean? Like, and, but, you know, as time progresses, you know, you keep going through it. And you know, so I was using it kind of to medicate because, man, you know, I got involved in street gangs and it was really violent, you know what I mean? The mid-80s in L.A., man, it was like all about punk rock and it was all about violence, you know what I mean? We're going to like Fenders and Long Beach and the
Fenders
Olympic
Ballroom.
Auditorium and all, you know, all those shows would basically just be big fights with bands that would play for however long they could play before the cops shut it down, you know what I mean? And being a 16-year-old kid, you know, I mean, in a way it was good, I guess, because I got surrounded by like these really big, tough guys that would protect me. But at the same time, it was like you're still involved in all that stuff, you know what I mean? And just watching all that. You know, all that stuff happened all the time.
Well,
it was
they're
a
formative
lot.
Years too.
Yeah.
You know, those are really forming your adult concepts.
Yeah,
you know what
of
I mean?
Like people, relationships.
Yeah,
like you know
Society.
How to get what you want in life.
Yeah.
Like what's going to happen to you? And so anyway, so that was going on, and then you know, kind of like the turning point for me, I guess, is I stayed down there for about a year and a half, and then I moved back to Portland. Mm-hmm. Just because it was too much for me to handle. And
what was your feeling then? Like when you're going back to Portland? Because you went
failure.
There for a dream. Really, you felt like a failure?
Yeah, man. At like 17 and a half, I felt like the biggest failure ever. I'm like, dude, there goes my dream. Like I wasn't tough enough to handle it. Like, why is this happening
what
to
was,
me? And,
yeah, what was the key, like, emotion or element? Like you said you weren't tough enough. Did you feel beat down? Was it a financial thing? You couldn't get a job? What was the main ingredient in that?
Yeah, it was kind of just, you know, like that. I felt that I was destined to be this rock and roll star and that I wasn't given a chance, you know? I was like the gods were against me, almost like I was starting to bring in some of that, like, God punishment stuff. Like, oh, I must be getting punished because, you know, I did this or I did that. And, you know, when I got back to Portland, I started, you know, dealing and stuff like that.
What were you dealing?
Mostly like weed and coke, you know? Yeah. And because I like to deal. I wasn't like one of those. I always like to say I like to deal the stuff I like to do. You know what I mean? Because that way I had somebody to have to worry about it, you know?
So, yeah.
But I wasn't like no Scarface. Like, there was no money to be made. You know what I mean? It would be like the...
You're getting high on your own supply.
Yeah, pretty much. You know what I mean?
So 16, 17.
18, you know? Yeah, what are you supposed to do at that point? You know
You're
what I
dealing
mean?
Like, cocaine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I met this guy, you know, and he was well-dressed and, you know, he had his act together and he was doing some bigger type dealing stuff. And when he came to me and he was like, hey, man, can you give me some heroin? And I was like, heroin? What are you out of your mind? Mm. That stuff's hardcore, man. Like, I don't deal with that kind of stuff. And then he told me how much money I could make. And I was like, well, you know what? Let me make a call. You know,
yeah.
Seriously, man. You know, you're like 17, 18 years old, man. You don't want to work a day job. And
Yeah, you only had a high school diploma and not really.
I got my GED, yeah.
Got a GED, so you weren't really doing much career stuff other than rock and roll.
I was like a bus boy.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And so, you know, what ended up happening is, you know, he got that. And then one day he came over and he was, you know, he was sick and I didn't know what that meant, you know. And he was like, hey, get me some foil. And I'm like, why, man? There's a bong on the table. Just use that. You know, it's like how ignorant I am.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, no, I'm not smoking a bong, you idiot. I'm trying to get high on heroin. I'm dope sick. I'm like, I don't know what that means. Here's some foil, right? And he starts smoking it. And I'm like, he goes, you want some? And I was like, you can smoke that? And like, I had no concept. I mean, I was thought, you know, my whole picture of like the junkie at that point was like, you know, the dirty bum down by the bridge, pushing a shopping cart, you know what I mean? Only needles, and you use needles and you die. So I didn't want to be a part of that. You know, I still wanted to be a rock and roll star, right? I'm still holding on to the dream. I'm only 18 years old, right?
Yeah.
And so once I found that out, I was like, well, you know what? I already smoke cigarettes and weed and everything else. I'm like, so you know what? Why not? Let's try it. And that's, you know, that's when you hear people talk about, man, I tried it that day and it was like, man. All of a sudden, it went from little insecure Chris Stewart, the failure in life, to like Chris Stewart, like invincible, you know, like in those 3 seconds, you know what I mean?
Wow.
And I remember just picking up my bass and hitting like the open E, and I was like transported like in the movies, and I was all of a sudden, I was like on stage at Madison Square Garden, 50,000 people, I'm like, okay, now I know what I need, now I'm ready, let's go back. So you know, I didn't pick up a habit or anything right off the bat, but I had that, and you know, I started getting into it, and then I moved back to Hollywood, and to make a big time go at it, and that's kind of where I stayed for quite a few years.
On your drug dealing money,
That was it, and you know, when I got back down to LA, and it was the same kind of thing. You know, I started playing in bands, and you know, that thing is the whole scene for me was always like the sense of community. You know what I mean? Like the metal scene and the punk scene in the beginning. You know, like. It's almost kind of like recovery is in a way, you know, in the beginning where it was like everybody didn't like each other. You know what I mean? There's like the metal guys and the punk guys and they hated each other. Yeah. And then they kind of started to blend in with thrash metal and everybody kind of came. And then all of a sudden nowadays everybody goes, because show is this show. You can whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's if I could say one thing, too, about that, you know, that's like the recovery community, man. Like we really need to work on that. You know what I mean? Like we can't be having up all these walls of like, oh, this guy's a heroin addict or this guy's into crystal or this guy's into alcohol. And you got to go to your own certain meetings and stuff like, man, we got over 100 people dying a day from this epidemic, man. And, you know, if these people come into your rooms, I'm asking you as a favor, if you're listening to this, man, if these people come into your rooms and you're in an AA meeting or something like that, man, just let them stay. You know what I mean? It's not going to kill you. You know what I mean? They don't have the option of going back out these days, man. They go back out and the drugs are too strong and, you know, you're killing people with your little, you know, weird, insignificant ways that nobody cares about. You know what I mean? Like, these are people's lives we're talking about. It's not about the failure to be willing. You know what I mean? These guys don't even know what it's like to be willing yet, man.
I think the spiritual axiom in that is the big problem is life in life is separate, right? I'm separate. I'm not like them or they're not like me. Or if you see somebody in the road, you're a bad driver and I'm not. We're always have the issue is always when we make ourselves separate. And there's something I heard my friend who's a rabbi say, he said, that's me when. So example, like instead of getting mad, that's me when I accidentally cut somebody off. That's me when I'm a junkie in an AA meeting or whatever, right? Like we're in everybody. You know what I mean? We've all been, nobody's perfect.
Parts of you, right? Because let's be honest, man, the whole thing about alcoholism and addiction and all those things is really, man, it's just a sense of loss, man. It's like somebody that's just was looking for something they couldn't find and they use this to supplement it and now it's turned into this big monster and they need help getting rid of it. That's what it is, man. Let's just keep it simple.
So let's throw in your song now. I think your first song is going to be Dropkick Murphys.
I thought it was. We could do either one. Let's do Amazing by Aerosmith. Yeah.
Let me see if I can do it. I don't know if I can. Let me see. Can I? I drag this. Wait, maybe if I drag this one.
If not, we could do either one. They're both awesome.
I don't think I can do it. Let me see. Sometimes I can get fancy with this thing over here. All right. I did it. No, I didn't. I went too far. Hold on. One more try. Oh, I've just screwed the whole show up now. I think I did it. Yeah. Okay. There we go. All right. So sorry about the delay, everybody at home. Okay. So we're going to play Amazing by Aerosmith. Why'd you choose this song?
Well, I chose this song as, you know, I have Amazing tattooed across my stomach as well, because it's just like amazing. Every day when I look in the mirror, I want it to be like this song, man. It's like, I let the right ones in, kept the wrong ones out, you know, angel of mercy to see me through all my sins. And it's just kind of like, to me, this was a song. Aerosmith was kind of like the first band that I knew of that really got sober. Yeah. And I was like, man, if those guys can do it, maybe I can do it.
They were junkies in the day.
Yeah, you know, and because that was the other thing too, man. Like when you're into rock and roll and you spend all your life in the lifestyle, like getting sober is treason. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to lose everything and everybody because nobody else wants to get sober with you. You know what I mean? It's like kind of like becoming a heroin addict at church. You know, like, nobody else is coming with you, bro. You know
what I
mean? Yeah. And so that was like one of I love the words of this song. And, you know, and when I knew everything that they went through, I was like, all right, you know what? Those guys can do it. Maybe I can do it. And that's what got this song going.
Well, that's amazing. All right, cool. So this is Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm here with my man, Chris Stewart. I'm your host, Wes Gear, and we'll be right back. This is Aerosmith Amazing. Tired of getting it. That was Aerosmith, amazing. This is Wes Gear, Rock to Recovery Radio on KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM, human crafted radio. This is a nonprofit, by the way. So if you're feeling spunky, you can go to KX93.5.com and donate. This whole studio and station and all the cool programming they do is totally self-funded. And also, this show is brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. They have a variety of great treatment programs for first responders now, mental health, addiction, et cetera. If you're looking for help, definitely check out New Vista Behavioral Health. Again, I'm your host, Wes Gear. I'm here with my man, Chris Stewart.
Ooh,
you, yeah. Who also wrote this book, Prayers, Punk Rock, and Pastry, From a Hopeless Dope Fiend to a Dopeless Hope Fiend, who did at one point sell his soul for rock and roll, but apparently got it back.
Oh, well, yeah. It was a tough fight, too, man. I'll tell you that. Mike Tyson is nothing on me, babe. I'll tell you that right now.
You got it back by giving the devil a piece of pie.
That's right.
Yeah. So we're talking about your story. So you're saying you had the rock and roll dream, and then you were growing up in Portland. Your family was missionaries at 15. Yeah. They were like, we are going to Europe to missionary, our brains out, you can come. And you're like, no, I want to rock. You went to L.A., that's right. Got turned out, so you went back to Portland, became a drug dealer, so you could go back to L.A. and really own it.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's where we're at.
And so what? We're about 18 years old in L.A.?
Yeah.
And then where do we go from there?
So where we go from there, you know, is kind of fast forward a little bit, because I really want to talk about solution-type stuff, because that's really what we all want to hear about. So for like the next 10 years, man, you know, I was playing in bands, living on the Sunset Strip, you know, doing all that kind of fun stuff. And, you know, at the time it was fun, you know, and I moved up to San Francisco.
But now you're into heroin.
Yeah. At this point, now I'm into heroin and, you know, I'm doing all that kind of stuff in downtown LA and things are getting a little bit dicey. And I always thought it was interesting, though, like when you're a heroin addict and you live on the Sunset Strip, you're like the nemesis. You know what I mean? It's like you can go to a party with all these guys rocking out. They'll put out a pile of coke the size of like a horse's head on the table, write their names in it, do it off strippers' behinds. You
glamorous.
Know what I mean? Yeah. And you pull out like a little bit of heroin and the whole party stops. Like, you have fun. Like, whoa,
what's
are you
your
doing?
Problem, dude?
Get out of here. You're like, what are you talking about? Like, you guys got like a kilo of coke. You're like, what's what? But, you know what ended up happening? So, anyway. Fast forward, you know, I was playing in bands and having a good time and everything was cool. And then I met this woman and...
Oh, it's her fault.
Yeah, you know, everything was going great and then not great and then great, then not great. And, you know, this is about 10, 11 years later and we decided, you know, and I was starting to get clean at this point. I'd been trying to get clean at this point for about 8 years off and on, you know. It
so
took me a long time to get sober.
You're late 20s by now.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
And
and you had just been smoking heroin, party, L.A. party boy. Yeah,
that's
no,
it.
No,
you know?
Shooting dope.
No, not really. Right. Not at this point. And because I wasn't trying to get a habit. You know?
Right, yeah.
But it wasn't working out too good. But I was thought, you know, like, I don't want to die. I just want to party, you know? Yeah. And
did you just not even talk to your parents these 10 years? You're just like, where
not
are
really.
You? Where?
Not really. Not unless I needed something, you know? And then I'd call and blame them for everything. And then they'd tell me they still weren't going to give me anything. And then I would just hang up.
Yeah,
so. That's
did
like
you feel like, did you feel like abandoned at all? I feel like, how could you not?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was definitely, you know, like, my drugs were definitely self-medicating, you know what I mean? It was like, I was using it to propel me into this rock stardom, so it was like, you know, like, I never said no to anything. I never, like, took a night off, you know, like, if I get a call at, like, 4 in the afternoon, hey, dude, we're going to the Rainbow, I'm like, I'm there.
Yeah.
You know, like, I might be puking at the time, I might just be laying in bed from the night before, and I'm like, you know what, I got a rally,
duty
bro.
Calls.
This could be the night. You know, this could be the night.
Nikki Six might be at the
exactly.
Rainbow.
Exactly. Nikki Six, I know Lemmy's going to be there, and I'm not letting Lemmy down, that's my brother, you know what I mean, right? And so I kept doing that, man, and anyway, I ended up getting married, and my wife was... I mean, she knew all about my addiction, but at the time, you know, I was trying to get clean, and I had a little bit of clean time, like maybe, I don't know, 30, 60 days. And we got married. We bought a house out in Culver City, and she was an executive at Activision Video Game Company. And so, you know, I had it made. All of a sudden, I had this, like, cool house out in, like, Santa Monica, Culver City area. She's working for Activision. They just released Tony Hawk Pro Skater. Yeah. I'm like, dude, like, I'm a kid from the streets. Like, I'm living the dream right now. You know what I mean? And so I'm like, okay, that's it. I'm done.
Were you working?
No. At the time, yeah, I worked at this company called eToys.com. I was like the mailroom guy, you know?
Okay.
Because I'm still going to make it big.
Crushing,
you know what I mean?
Just,
yeah, right? And you know what happened is that when I could have quit, I didn't want to quit. And when I wanted to quit, I couldn't quit.
Bam.
And that was it, man. And within a year, you know, she kicked me out. And I don't blame her. I mean, she gave me every opportunity there was. And finally, there was just, you know, too much money missing, too many lies, too much of this, too much of that.
So you started stealing money from your...
joint bank account.
Joint bank
that
account.
That wasn't in my name.
Yeah.
And, you know, what happened then is... at 30 years old, man, I was completely homeless, man. She kicked me out, and I had nowhere to live. I lived in my car, and after like 30 days, they towed that for parking tickets. And I lived right over there on like Yucca and Wilcox, man, right on Hollywood Boulevard, you know. And I slept in the bushes off of Los Palmas, and, you know, I dig through the trash for food and steal, man.
That went bad fast.
Yeah, it did go bad fast, you know. And
in the bushes.
In the bushes, you know, the shopping cart guy, you know what I mean? Save, trying to panhandle enough money to go to Playboy Liquor and get a tall can of King Cobra. You know what I mean? Like, those were the days. You know, that's where I was at. And, but, you know, the whole thing is I kept telling myself, I'm not an addict. You know what I mean? Like, I'm still going to be this rock star. Like, the last thing I carried around was my 1976 Gibson Thunderbird bass. That was all I owned, right? And, like, I wasn't letting it go.
Did you sleep with it in the bushes?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me? I didn't let that thing out of my sight. I bought it from Wood at Voltage Guitars, man,
back when
I was, like, 19. I kept that thing forever. I love that. Because, you know, Nikki Sixx played that. Right, that was the whole thing. Like, me, Tom Hamilton, and Nikki Sixx were, like, the only three guys that played the Thunderbird. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And
now, were you answering, like, you know, wanted musician ads in the recycler?
I wasn't doing nothing, man. I was just trying to stay alive. You know what I mean?
Okay, but you had the bass.
Yeah.
Just in case somebody called you on the phone
that
you didn't
have.
As
soon as I come back from this, it's going to be epic. You know what I mean? This is going to add to my street cred, you know?
Oh, my God.
And, you know, and what happened was like about a year later, I was just unrecognizable to myself. And so I had to email my sister.
So how long you were in the bushes for a year?
About a year, yeah.
Wow.
And, and the thing was, you know, is that being 15 and 16 and living on those streets, I was used to it almost. You know what I mean? It was like you said, formative years. So like to be back there at that age, I'm like, well, I already know what to do to survive. You know what I mean? I'll go here. I know where they toss this out. I can call this person. I can do this. I can
eating,
you know,
out of trash cans, panhandling, sleeping in the bushes for
just,
a year,
you know,
at 30 years old.
Just mad at the world. Like, I can't believe everybody let me down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that addictive mentality. And you know, and I'll tell you. And then for the next 10 years, I'd get some sobriety and good things would happen. And then, you know, I'd go back down. And finally, man, at 39, like I'm waking up. I would wake up. I had a bottle of, like a half gallon of vodka next to the bed. I'd take a shot.
So you got out of the outdoors. Somehow.
Yeah, I got out of the outdoors. I had some jobs. You know what I mean? I was trying to build things up. They just keep crashing down.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at the end there, I'm living in Las Vegas at this point because what better place for alcoholic to live in Las Vegas? You know,
sure.
There's somebody always worse than you, right? Until that one day when there's not.
Oh, man.
And that was it, man. And I take the shot of vodka. I had like this paint bucket next to my bed. I'd throw up, take another shot, throw up, take another shot. Hopefully that one would stay down. I'd snort half an 80 Oxycontin off the dresser, smoke a little bit of weed, and then lay in the fetal position for about 5 minutes and 21 seconds to 5 minutes and 27 seconds, which was the exact amount of time it took for everything to finally kick in.
I mean, were you watching it like a timer?
Oh, yeah. Because,
really?
You know, when you're in that stage, but, you know, like, you got to watch the time because you're cringing.
We do weird stuff.
Right?
Dude.
You're just cringing, man. You're like, you can barely hold on, man. You're just like watching the second hand go, like, come on, kick in.
So that was your habit of doing that and then watching the timer and knowing that in that time range, you're going to be feeling
just
good.
Just like close your eyes and pray for five minutes and hope you can make it. You know what I mean?
It's quite an experiment you're running.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I had, you know, kind of like that moment of clarity where I'm like, man, like, I'm just going to die, you know? I mean, like, at this point, I'm incapacitated, laying on my bed, just getting drunk and high all the time, and the jobs were gone. Everything was gone. I had nothing. And so I decided, you know what? I had a friend in San Diego, and I'm like, you know what, man? Like, today's the day. And so I just literally, through a series of events, everything else dried up, man, and I grabbed whatever money I had. I got in my car, and at 39 years old, man, I had an acoustic guitar, a skateboard, and like some clothes. That's it.
Yeah.
And I drove to San Diego. And
why'd you go there? You had a sober friend?
Not a sober friend, just a friend.
Just a
like
friend.
The only friend pretty much I had left.
They get hard to come by at the end, don't they?
They do.
Yeah.
And you know, and I got there and you know, and I started coming to meetings, you know, because like I said, that was me at 10 years trying to get sober right there, right? Like that morning routine. That was my morning routine.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I knew where to go and I got into, you know, AA and moved into a sober living. I've never been to treatment. Never been to any rehabs ever. I always just had to do it on my own. I didn't have insurance and didn't ask for help and, you know, took the tough way.
So you walked into a meeting?
Yeah.
Who turned you on to that? How'd you hear that?
I looked it up online. I went into this place called God's Garage down in Pacific Beach. And, yeah, man. And I started going to meetings and getting everything back. And then, you know, I had 3 years. And, you know, I got everything back, right? I was a manager of a sober living. I had a brand new car. I was engaged again. This would have been number three. I'm a romantic. You know what I mean? That's it. And, you know, and I had money. I had a good job. And one day somebody came up to me when I was at work at this restaurant. They're like, hey, man, we just opened this $200 bottle of wine. I know you don't drink, but you should try it. And I was like, you know what? I don't drink. And things are going so good. I will try because it's a $200 bottle of wine. I'm a wine expert, right? And yeah. I took a drink and nothing happened. And I was like, that's it.
Right.
Right? I'm really just a heroin addict. I'm not an alcoholic. This is great news, Wes.
Great news,
right? And, you know, within a week, I'm drinking around the clock, you know, like the Mike's Hard Lemonade's at 7-Eleven at like 7 a.m. You know, like, hey, you got any more of that raspberry lemonade? You know what I mean? You come to this big Hollywood rock star wannabe junkie guy to like begging Mike's Hard Lemonade's, you know what I mean? Yeah. At 7 a.m. It's not a pretty picture.
Well, I like a couple things that you pointed out there is like in the literature, some recovery literature, they talk about people who know they should be sober, right? They're armed with all this knowledge. Like, yep, I know I got a problem. I know I got to be sober. And they talk about the peculiar mental twist that precedes the first drink when we start again. And it's mixed with, quote, sound logic, right? And it happened to me. And I've had it with people I work with. Like, well, I was just going to sell heroin. I wasn't going to do it, right? And that made so much sense.
Yeah.
And we get and it talks us into getting loaded again. And so to you, right, you're like, that's right. Having a little drink of wine, which isn't my problem, will be okay.
Yeah.
And the next thing you said, which is the most scary thing, is when we know maybe, because it sounds like you were waiting to see what happened. You took a drink and nothing bad happened.
Yeah.
And that's almost the worst thing that could happen.
Instant justification.
Because right? You're like, oh, yeah, I get it. And then curious. We're like, see, I was overreacting.
Why don't they tell you this in the meetings? Yeah. 3 years is all you need, man. This is great.
I'm new again. Yeah. Once we're pickles, we never go back to cucumbers.
Yeah, right.
And that's another thing. So many people talk about, like, my drug of choice. Now, I did have a friend. He was a tweaker. He swore, and he did 12 steps, and he swore drinking wasn't his problem. And sure enough, he can drink, and he only drinks half a beer. And then I'm like, well, you're not an alkie. But I know so many people that have your story. More people that have your story. My challenge is to think of this. If you're out there saying, oh, my problem's pills or my problem's, you know, heroin or it's meth or whatever, let me put you on a deserted island with none of that and just piles of whiskey and tell me that you're not going to be drinking this hell out of that whiskey. You know what I mean?
Not going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple who maybe would.
Maybe,
But I think more times than not, Anyhow, so...
I agree with you on that one too. You know what I mean? It's like, just cut your losses.
Because
we're about to talk about is like how awesome life can get when you don't have to deal with any of that stuff. You know?
Okay, and let's do that. Let's throw in this song. We're gonna throw in the next song. Now this is "Amazing Grace" by Dropkick Murphys. Why'd you pick this one?
This is great. What a great segue. Because this is my morning routine now. Like I just told you guys my morning routine before today. My morning routine is that the first thing I do is I play this song, Amazing Grace, by the Dropkick Murphys. I crank it up. I sit on the side of my bed. I thank God for another day to be clean and sober. I get up. I look out the window. I thank him for a gorgeous day of sun, which luckily, because I live in paradise, it mostly is. And then I go over to a picture of the New Orleans Superdome because I'm a Saints fan. And I say right in there, I'm like, New Orleans Superdome, are you ready to rock? My name is Chris Stewart, and this is my story of hope. And that's it. And that's how I start every day now, man. It's killing it.
I love it. Rock to Recovery Radio with Chris Stewart. Dropkick Murphys. We'll be right back. Can you guys just totally imagine our boy Chris Stewart over here totally like waking up and coming to and just
that's it, man. It's like wild energy coming at you, man.
I could totally see that you doing
There's
that.
There's no going back after that, I'll tell you that.
No, like, you're definitely not going back to sleep after that. So this is Rock to Recovery Radio, KX93.5 FM, Laguna's only FM. I'm your host, Wes Geer. This show is also brought to you by New Vista Behavioral Health. We are sitting here with best-selling author and former junkie rock and roll friggin' whatever, fill in the blank.
Yeah, right? Fill in the blank. Yeah. There's a lot of things you can do.
Yeah, he went from a hopeless dope fiend to a dopeless hope fiend. This is Chris Stewart, and he's got his book, Prayers, Punk Rock, and Pastry. And so you were just telling your story. You, at what, about 40 years old, you get sober?
Yeah.
And so you were talking about your morning routine. And what's been keys to your recovery, and what do you want to share about now?
Yeah,
about the sober life that's so rad, the vortex of radness, as we say.
It is the vortex of radness. You know, and to me, it boils down to, I mean, two big things. One is prayer and meditation. You know, when I had come back from that last like relapse, and you know, and I thought, you know, if you're listening out there, man, like, listen, that was me at 13 years of trying to get sober. That's where I was at. You know what I mean? That's a long time. That is a crappy return on investment. You know what I mean? And at that point, I thought, I must be one of the ones they talk about that can't get it right, the constitutionally incapable of getting it. I can't get honest. I can't do this. And the thing I realized is, you know, like, I'd never really done prayer and meditation, right? I still kind of held this resentment against, you know, organized religion and all these things. And I don't like to sit still, you know? So it's like, I was, you know, could pray, but I could never really meditate. But I realized, man, like, that's, I have to at least try it one more time. So if you're listening, man, if you have trouble with the prayer and meditation, I'll give you this real simple deal, man. You've been driving down the road, either drunk or high, and a cop pulled behind you, like, dear God, please don't let me get pulled over. Well, congratulations, now you know how to pray. And if you've ever been laying dope sick or alcohol sick on your bathroom floor with like your face against the tile, just like praying that you won't move and throw up again, like, congratulations, you know how to meditate. Right there, there's your prayer and meditation, right? It saved your life. And you know,
and that was free.
Yeah, that was free.
No charge.
And I say it kind of jokingly, man, but that's really all it takes, man. It's a daily, you know, it's just a conscious contact, right? Like, you don't have to be Joel Osteen, right? You don't have to get up and give this, like, 30-minute prayer every day. You don't have to be, like, Gandhi and sit in a room full of candles with, like, a waterfall sound in the background and, you know, doing all this stuff, man. It's like, you can sit in your car for, like, a minute and just calm yourself, man, do some breathing. You know, I know, Wes, you do breathing stuff, too. And I'm telling you, man, you make that little conscious contact. That's what it says, right? 24 hours based on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, man. That's all you get.
Yep.
I'm telling you. And that's... I've been doing that for over almost five and a half years now, and here I am, you know what I mean? And just taking those small little steps, you know what I mean? Like, remember, it took you a long time to become an addict or an alcoholic, and it's going to take a little bit of while for you to get, like, solid on sober ground, you know? But
yeah,
there's so much stuff that you can do to help out, you know? And one of the biggest things I decided was, you know, since I left home at 15 and I had all that issues of abandonment and I had, like, you know, all that violence and stuff that happened to me at an early age, I was like, you know what, man, like, I want to go back and I want to help out kids, you know, and that's what kind of where I started Buns and Roses. Buns and Roses was kind of given to me on a dare in a leadership conference where they were like, okay, we want you to pick two things that you love to do that are in your heart that you can make sustainable even after you die that will help other people. And most people, you know, were like, oh, yeah, I'd like to do, you know, clean water and yoga and, you know, and these people are going to do this and that. And I'm like, that's cool. And I'm like, you know what? The two things I love the most, heavy metal and cinnamon rolls. Right. So that's like, that's how I'm starting my company. And so I started out by doing cinnamon rolls and passing them out and stuff. And I started working it and doing cupcakes and cakes. And really it was a way to give back to the sober community for birthday parties and stuff. And then people started hiring me. And then I started working with like boys and girls clubs. And I ended up starting these leadership programs in San Diego high schools. And you know, and as I started doing that, I started working with continuation high schools, right? And started some of the only leadership programs in continuation high schools in the country. And it was only because I could go in there with that story of like, hey, listen, man, I get what it's like to feel like a misfit in a teenager, man. I get what it's like, you know, if you're an artist, if you're a creative, you know, I would say like if you're a dreamer, you can't use logical thinking, right? Like people get that confused. I'm like, if you're a dreamer, just be a dreamer, man. You know what I mean? Like, don't try and like be a dreamer in a logical world because you will fail every time, you know? So we started doing that, right? And then we started like doing these events and, you know, and I started having these kids come in and, you know, like I said, learn a skill, learn how to bake cupcakes, man. It's like nothing crazy, but at least it's something to where they can go and get a job at Starbucks or something, because at least they know what to kind of do. You know what I mean? It gets them over that initial fear. And plus, it gave them
some self-esteem.
And
some productivity and some self-worth, yeah.
And also, like, you know, I take them on adventures and we'd go do stuff so they could see, like, oh, man, this guy's doing, he's sober, this is cool, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or whatever's going on. And also, I'd give them a nice letter of recommendation. So when they went in, it's like they had something that says, like, hey, I'm worth something.
That's cool.
And that's key for these guys. And I don't know.
There's some irony there.
Yeah.
Because you became a missionary,
yeah,
like your parents. Because that's what my mom says. She's in the church. She's not all, you know, crazy. She doesn't beat anybody over the head with it by any means. But she's like, you're musical missionaries, because we do Rock to Recovery.
Yeah, you guys
and
are, man.
We're not wrapped in the Bible or anything, but I think you're a missionary when you go around carrying a message of light in whatever words you're using. And that's what you're doing. Like, you're saying, here's how I found the light, and you're sharing that with people. How ironic, right?
It is. You know, and I agree. It's like when you go around and you spread the light of something and you serve people. I mean, that's really what you're there to do. And so, you know, I do that. I do a couple of camps every year where I help out kids in leadership camps. You know, we have a big camp for high school juniors that I do with my Rotary Club. I belong to the Rotary Club of Del Mar as well, which is a cool deal. It gets me in a lot of places.
Yeah.
Gets me a lot of great speaking gigs, so I can go in and tell them, you know, hey, this is the face of a heroin addict. Like, what?
Yeah.
That's impossible. Look at you. I'm like, dude, look at me. Here's the old picture. And they're like, wow, you were.
Yeah. Oh, you know what I mean?
Like, well, here's my book. They're like, wow, you are. You know? Yeah. And that's the thing about writing a book is, you know, I call myself like the Ramones of the author world. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I dropped out of school in 10th grade, right? I got my G. So, like, man, I wrote the book. The grammar was terrible. Everything was. I had to get a lot of help for the book. But I did it because people need to know that you can recover and that you can have these lives that are great that you talk about and that you can do whatever you want to do. You know, like,
yeah,
when I go and I talk to people, I know they're not going to remember everything I said. And so, like, having the book there is just a way for me to go, hey, take this home and read it so you remember what I was talking about, you know? And it's like, if you can even save one person, like, that's all I really care about. You know, like, I'm not making any money off the book. You know, it's not like it's doing crazy things like that. And that's not why I wrote it.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote it so, because I feel like when I was looking around for books in recovery, you know, I'd read, like, you know, the heroin diaries or something. Like, that's not really giving me any recovery. You know what I mean? Like, and I don't want to glamorize drug use anymore. I don't want to be like Charles Bukowski anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Like, and so it's like, and I didn't really see any books of people that were getting sober that were regular people. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I see some rock stars write books, which is awesome. But, like, I'm still that wannabe rock star, right? Like, I never made the Ferrari list, right? Like, I got to, like, a convertible. That's about it. You know what I mean? Like, I could call Sunset Strip my home. Like, oh, congratulations. You know what I mean? Like, but so it's like for all the people out there that, you know, that didn't make it in their first dream, like, this is a book for you to say, hey, man, there's still hope. Like, you can still come back, man. No matter how low you've been, man. I was pushing a shopping cart, ripping off Hollywood T-shirts off the side of the road just so I had a shirt to wear. You know what I mean? Like, and now, you know, I get to work with kids all over the country. You know, I'm approved by Southern California public schools to speak in schools. You know, I get to do all these awesome things, you know, that I never would have thought was possible at a lot of stages in my life.
And you feel good doing it.
I feel great doing it, you know?
You could tell hearing you that you're not just like, yeah, I do this. You're like excited about it. You're passionate about it. And that's what we kind of learn is, in, I think, in recovery, is that there's a whole other way to get happy. And it's being of service, having a productive life, and being passionate about helping others. It's just the common theme of people like us. We're talking about today, a bunch of my friends in recovery. The opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
A lot of people say that, you know, and it's even more, it's like this connection with, like, this higher power. So you have this thing that, like, no matter what you do, you know that you still have at least one thing on your side, right?
Yeah.
And then it's like by doing esteemable acts or by just being a good person, then you build this other community around you, all different kinds. And, you know, I'm not friends with everybody. I don't have, like, you know, I'm not, like, going out with, like, 20 people every night to coffee and pizza or whatever it is. Like, that's not really my scene. But it's like the people that I have in my life, they're always there. I know I can count on them, right? It's like if I make the phone call.
A lot more than a junkie.
Yeah, you know, and that's it. And you know, and it's like just getting over that fear, Wes. You know what I mean? Like, it's like I used to live in this constant fear because, you know, like when you're a dope fiend, man, like you live in constant fear. Like, I'm never going to have enough.
Yeah.
I'm running out. I don't have enough. There's cops. There's people. Blah, 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 right? And that, like, get your brain going, man, where it's like psychological. So, of course, you know, like when you get early sobriety, you're still living in all this fear because you're just used to being paralyzed by fear. And it's like once you get past that, you know, which takes a while and it takes some work, but Once you get past it, like today, I was easy to say when I got to AA, I had big problems and a small God. Today, I got a big God, I got small problems.
Yeah. Now you're in the vortex of radness, homie.
I'm right here in the vortex,
dude,
man.
We're creating it, man. Yeah.
There's like a hurricane in Laguna. If you guys are driving by here, man, I'm telling you, man. There's like a hurricane of sobriety on the Pacific Coast Highway, man.
Dude, you're rad. So this has been an interview with my man, a neat dude, Chris Stewart. Whose latest book, right, is The Prayers, Punk Rock, and Pastry. Check it out. Pick up the book. Chris, thank you so much for coming down here. You're a rad dude. Thanks for your service and helping everybody. If you're out there looking for help, man, you're worth it. You can do it, too. If I can do it, if Chris can do it, you can do it.
You can do it.
Yeah, this has been Rock to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Wes Gear, and we are out of here.
Later.
KXRN LP, Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX 93.5.